Welcome to the Been There, Done That podcast with Angela Dunn Cartledge.
Hi, everybody. This is the Been There, Done That podcast. I'm your host, Angela Dunn Cartledge, and I'm here with Ashley Poklar. We are going to talk grief today, and we are going to talk therapy today. So I can't wait to have this conversation. Ashley, thank you so much for being here.
Not a problem. Thank you for having me.
I would love for you to tell our audience more about you and about your work. And I'm, again, so excited to have this conversation because I think it's so important, especially right now in our world.
Sure. So as you mentioned, my name is Ashley Poklar. I am a clinical psychologist. I started out as a special education teacher, and I worked with kids that had pretty significant trauma backgrounds. They were the kids that got kicked out of their school districts for quote unquote bad behavior. But the reality was most of them were just holding a lot of feelings and trying to figure out how to navigate a world that wasn't very understanding or accepting of that. I had my first daughter and wasn't sure I could be the parent I wanted to be and the teacher I needed to be. And so I went back to school for a master's in counseling and then on for a doctorate in psychology. And talking about grief, I lost my brother, my younger brother, in between the first and second year of my doctoral program. So I was pregnant with my fourth child, basically in survival mode and trying to navigate grief while also not taking an incomplete for classes and things like that. And I went on to work in school settings and community settings as a psychologist and found a way to homeschool my kids and to work for a nonprofit that focuses on anti-child sexual exploitation and trafficking. So there's a lot of grief work that happens in that space. Not necessarily from loss of life, but from loss of identity, loss of self, loss of trust in people that you should be able to trust. And so navigating my own grief while also learning to help other people, particularly children and their parents, navigate grief.
That is such important work. My goodness. The emotional side of that, I can't wait to dig into this, but how you keep yourself separate from all of that has got to be a mighty challenge. But we'll get to that in a minute. I wanted to really focus on the grief side of your work that you do now, but also the grief side of the work that you did as a teacher, because there's so many pieces, I feel, of our grief and trauma stories that were created when we were children. And that loss of security is such a big piece of it that we don't give each other enough credit to go back and fix that and be aware of it, be intentional with it, and those kinds of things. Talk us through your theory, your way of going about really digging in and how you see that grief journey kind of flowing from folks.
Yeah, that's a great question. As a special education teacher, particularly working in the what they call SED, severe emotionally disturbed space, what I found, and I think what many of us find, is that the relationship is key to anything that you do with these kiddos. And they, most of them have self-fulfilling prophecies that adults can't be trusted. Adults are not there for them. Adults are not there to do what's best for them. That adults are out for only themselves. So in order to get them to do any actual academic work, you have to get them to trust you. And you don't do it through the usual, well, I'll trust them when they trust me, or that idea that somehow you get kids to trust you by being authoritarian. Not maybe normal kids, but not kiddos that have experienced trauma.
Right, or that they have to earn it in some way, right?
Like, yes.
That's not how it works in this situation. I'm so with you. Sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, like really, it's as the adult, you have to earn their trust. And once they trust you, then you're good. And you have to come in every day and start every day as if it's a new day. And that's really hard. That our brains aren't made to work that way. Our feelings aren't made to work that way. To sit there and have a kid cuss you out, call you all kinds of names, threaten you, threaten your family. I had a kid punch me in the face, and then come in the next day and be ready to start again and to try again. And the theory behind that is attachment theory. The idea that these kids, they don't have strong attachment. They don't have healthy attachment styles. They either weren't taught, they weren't modeled those appropriate styles from their parents who were struggling as well, or their attachment style was broken by some sort of big break of trust, trauma, abuse, those kinds of things. So their way of attaching is not a healthy way of attaching. And as the adult, most of us have our own idiosyncrasies and flaws in how we attach. And if we're not aware of that, then we're both coming at the relationship in an unhealthy way. And it just breeds continued distress and continued problems. And it's hard. It is hard to be the adult in the room and to have to force yourself to be the adult in the room. And in, you know, relationships with 10 to 12 children or teenagers, I worked with the teens who have a hard time attaching, and be able to come in each day and be like, we're starting fresh and we're going to try to attach today. But if you do it enough and you do it every day, they start to expect you to be that person, to be that sounding board, to be that safe space for them to express and emote however they're going to express and emote, but no, it's not going to break the relationship. And we see that with our own children, you know, when I work with families and parents are like, they're great at school, but they're awful at home. It's because it's safe to be awful at home. It's safe to be able to feel all of your feelings and express all of your feelings, because you know that no matter what happens, mom, dad, they're going to come back and they're going to be that safe haven for you. And as a teacher, especially with those kinds of kiddos, you really have to strive to be that safe haven for them.
It seems so... I hear you saying it's emotionally draining, but I also hear that it, by being that consistent force in their life, that you, it can be very rewarding on the flip side of that crazy coin, you know? It is, I can only imagine what that would be on a day in, day out basis. And how did you disconnect from it when you came home? How was that? How did that work for you? And I, like, you just, I know I can imagine that it was a process, is all I want to give you lots of grace and hugs from here, because I can imagine that was a learning adjustment, evolution, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, it's hard. I think everybody kind of finds their own way. What worked for me was kind of twofold, and it's still what I use today in the work I do now. First and foremost is finding the value and the meaning and the purpose in what I do. And so, yeah, we probably didn't learn fractions or the academic stuff like we should have been, 10 kids from non-readers to gifted all in the same class. I would guess that my success on paper as a teacher was not that great, but I found value and purpose and meaning in connecting with the students. I found meaning in them being able to express themselves using words instead of throwing things across the room. I found meaning in them sharing something that they had been struggling with without it turning into something big, and them being able to problem solve or collaborate with one another, you know, meeting their goals, whatever that goal might be on their IEPs. And so being able to consistently remind myself of what the purpose was, what I got meaning out of, and finding success in those smaller moments, that helped me stay grounded. It helped me not get burnt out. And then I just had a routine. So the drive home was my way to drop everything, to process everything, to listen to music that let me kind of yell in the car or cry in the car or whatever was needed in that moment. Because, you know, these kids came with heavy stories. And oftentimes, because we had the relationship we had, I was privileged, but also had to hold that burden. Burden's not the right word. Hold that reality of hearing their story and sharing in their story with them, and seeing that the world was not what I had grown up in all the time, and that this was the reality for these kids. And so having that kind of reset moment was particularly important. And I fine-tuned it more as I went, particularly when I had kids to come home to. It's one thing when you come home to just a spouse and you're just kind of, and your dogs, and you can be cranky and you can be turned off, and it's not the end of the world, but you can't come home cranky and turned off and shut down and then also interact with your children in a healthy way.
Yeah. And you're breaking the cycle by doing that. And that is so critical in those moments to realize you have your own family to raise and to be a part of. And I'd love to hear how you took that experience and carried that into your psychologist role, your therapy practice, and what that sort of, how that morphed for you, how that evolved from there.
Yeah. So as I moved into the psychology space and had the kids, again, that purpose and meaning was incredibly important. That has been my driving force. As I went through school and as I made decisions for what I do with my life, as well as how I raise my own kids, I have been really purposeful with, as I call it, living my values. I make sure that the decisions that I make around my work life, around my personal life, are tied directly back to the things that I value most. Because when you're living your values, you're living in more congruence, you're more content. When hard things happen, they don't feel as hard because there's some purpose or meaning to it. So I've carried that through. I don't always have the ability to turn things off or to you know, especially now that most of my work is either long trips and then I come home directly from them, or virtual stuff. So I'm on a call, a heavy call, and then my kids are there because I homeschool now. And so it's a lot of modeling for my kids. That was a rough phone call. Mommy's going to go take a few minutes to kind of reset, and then I'll jump into that with you. It's being able to catch that self-awareness, catching when I'm feeling overwhelmed before I'm acting like I feel overwhelmed. So, you know, once you get that little, like, I can't stop thinking about this client, or I'm feeling just kind of off, I'm a little bit irritable, catching it early before it's impacting the relationship with my own kids. And I think this is most important, forgiving myself when I don't, realizing that a phrase that I love is good enough parenting is good enough. And I like to remind myself of that often, because you don't have to be perfect to have kids that grow up healthy and successful. In fact, the more that you try to be perfect, there's a law of diminishing returns, and you're actually harming them by being so perfect and fixing all of their problems that they don't learn how to navigate hard things. And so I try to give myself grace. I'm not always great at it. And then have that conversation with the kids afterwards. Yeah, mommy had a lot going on, and I was thinking about, you know, the kids that I was working with, and that took over, and I wasn't really thinking about you and what you needed in that moment, and I'm really sorry.
I think that is so important, and I'm actually feeling validated right now, because I do the same thing, that the moments that we know we're imperfect, they actually need to see that. They need to see that we don't handle everything perfectly, because then they start to feel inferior or smaller, or, I definitely don't want that. And I know I'm hearing you say you don't either. But what I love the most about what you're saying is that it's a process. It's not just, cool, I found it, I'm all done, but that it is an evolution. It is about reevaluating whenever that needs to happen. And that then creates that resilience muscle in you, which then you're modeling. And then we have a beautiful circle that comes out of that. So I think that is fantastic advice. And I personally will be taking that with me as a mom, but also as a mom that works primarily from home and also homeschools, it makes a lot of difference in those things to be able to have the moments, but also to interact with them and to let them know there's a balance there. back to what you were saying about the difficult moments and the harder phone calls, how do you coach, or do you, let me ask this question, do you coach adults that are trying to figure out their childhood trauma, or do you still deal with children primarily now, especially in, as you detailed at the beginning, the sexually exploited and trauma piece of things? Is there a blend, or is it simply a childhood response?
So a lot of what I do is the immediate crisis response. So it's the support for the child, but with the support for the child comes the support for the adults that care for the child. And oftentimes they're holding their own trauma, either their own upset at what happened and how they weren't able to stop it or didn't see it. But oftentimes it's that paired with their own childhood pieces and parts that are playing into it. Oftentimes traumatized parents end up with traumatized children. And so there is that cycle. And then I also work a lot with our partner organizations that provide the aftercare support. I work on the side of supporting the providers. And so a lot of what I've been doing with our partners in Uganda and in Jamaica is helping them to learn self-care practices. And I actually wrote a book on self-care in various ways, and the finding meaning is in there because that's one that I find helpful. But so are countless other ways, many different ways to find that self-care that works best for them, so that they can continue to do the kind of work that they do. And part of that, at times, particularly with the supervisees that I work with one-on-one, there tends to be their own stuff. People bring their own stuff, and being a therapist tends to make your stuff come to the surface, because if one thing wasn't true about therapy, it's usually towards the beginning, you will have countless clients that all have the same problem that you have not fixed yet. And so it bubbles up, and it makes you face what you're doing in order to do a good job for the people that you're serving.
Absolutely. And I love that you are focusing on the self-care for the caregiver, that is so important. And I particularly resonated with the responsibility piece for the adults that felt like they could have prevented something, and how that manifests itself. There are so many pieces of this that I want to ask, but I think where I want to start is there a way to see warning signs? Is there a way as a parent, as a guardian, as a caregiver, to understand what's happening ahead of time? Or are the bad guys getting better at what they're doing faster than we're at realizing it? What does that look like in your work?
So the reality is the bad guys have a really good understanding of child development. I think a better understanding than most parents do of what normal teen development looks like. And so they're really good at identifying vulnerable youth. They're really good at figuring out just through a couple of little chat lines, which kiddos or teens are more likely to tell their parents and which ones are more likely to keep things to themselves. They're able to tell which ones are looking for connection, and they're really good at the grooming process. And so as a parent, what you're looking for is those signs that grooming might be occurring. And what that looks like on the parent side is, and unfortunately it also is normal teen behavior in a lot of ways, which is why a lot of parents don't catch it, because it's hiding out in your room, pulling away from your family, changing friend groups. And it's those things that we're like, well, I mean, that's kind of normal teenage behavior, give them some space. But when it starts to become, your child's not who they were, like they're starting to be sullen, or they're getting like smart alecky with you and they weren't always, big thing if they're hiding their phone, closing it, like turning it off when you walk by, closing their computer when you walk by, sneaking their phone into their room at night, things like that. Anything like related to being sneaky with the phone is an immediate something's up. And it might, hopefully it's not that they're being groomed, but they're having conversations they shouldn't be having, or that they think you don't want them to be having. There's something going on there beyond normal teenage behavior. So it's while these aren't red flags for there's definitely grooming going on, they're yellow flags that you should be having conversations with your child. And that if they're unwilling to talk to you, maybe you should be considering reaching out to additional supports, whether that's a counselor or an uncle or an aunt that your child loves and is willing to have those real conversations with, or a family friend. But you want to make sure that when you start to see those yellow flags, that you're taking note of them, and not just taking note, but actually trying to converse with your child. And best case scenario, you've been having those conversations from the beginning so that it's nothing new. But the reality is families are busy, parents are busy, kids are busy. And so oftentimes there's not time for those preventative, just relationship rapport building conversations with your child. So oftentimes we don't have real conversations with our children until there's a problem. And those are hard to have if you don't have that relationship built up.
That makes a lot of sense. And from my own experience, I want to make sure that I am having those right conversations along the way, and not making decisions out of fear, but being honest about what bad guys do, and being able to say, just talk to me, just be able to not hold it in if you think that it's embarrassing or you think that it's something that I don't want to hear. I'd actually rather that be the opposite. We can have hard conversations. And so that is, I think, my work as a parent, is to be able to open that door and be able to say, yeah, I don't know that I would have told somebody that, but that's okay, because this is how we can fix it, and whatever. And again, going back to your original point when we were talking about disconnecting from the emotions of what you do anyway, is that we can be imperfect in that response and then still come back and build the groundwork again, put those bricks back in place that we just busted out with a big fat hammer. But we can build that back again, even if we've been incredibly imperfect every time we've reacted. There are ways to build that trust back. And so I'm feeling hope in what you're saying, in that even if our audience is thinking, I've never responded appropriately, or I've never asked those questions, it's never too late to ask those questions and to be involved, because now you can start to set the right ground rules and get that foundation built.
Yeah, it's interesting, because as you were talking, it made me think about how what I was talking about earlier about being that teacher in that space, and how I'm talking about being a parent and that attachment figure. A lot of the skills are very similar. It's this idea that if you can practice having conversations with your child about slightly upsetting things and emotionally regulate yourself and show your child, you can come to me about things and I can be at least like somewhat calmer than you thought I would be, and we can navigate this. Then when it's the big scary things, they're more willing to come and tell you. Because a lot of parents say, like a lot of parents that I talk to in this space, when their child has ended up in a grooming situation, or, you know, like a sextortion where they send pictures of themselves and things like that, parents often say, we talked about this. I told them what to look out for. They know that they're supposed to come to me. I told them that they could come to me. They always could have come to me. And then what the child says is, I was ashamed. And yeah, I could have come to them, but they would have been mad, and they would have taken my phone, and they would have flipped out, and they would have been upset, and I didn't want them to be upset. So as a parent, you're thinking to yourself, before this happens, I have to present this space where if my child drops small tidbits of upsetting information, I can be calm. And if you're finding that you can't, that's work you have to do for yourself. And can you blow up and be upset and fix it? Yes, you have to have that follow-up processing conversation of, You know, you came to me and you needed me to be calm and supportive. And instead, all I could think about was your safety and how I was worried about you. And that took forefront. And that wasn't what you needed. That was something I had to handle for myself so that I could be what you needed me to be. And having those conversations, because what kids will do, and I've seen them do it with parents, I've seen them do it with me in sessions, is they'll drop 20% of the truth to see how you react. And if you react in a way that suggests that you can't handle the whole truth, they don't tell you the rest. They just give you the 20% and decide that you're not a safe person to share the rest of the information with.
It's so important. And what I hear you saying also is that it's an ongoing process. This isn't just them coming to you with one small piece and then that's the end of the conversation. We have to keep engaging. We have to keep not just trusting in the silence, but keep saying, okay, so then what? What happened then? What happened the next day? Or what happened the next time that person texted you or whatever? And there's going to be, I think the hardest part for me, and that's going to be my next question, is how to have repercussions without degrading the trust. And so being consistent on understanding that this is not a good thing, but also saying the reason I'm doing this is because I love you beyond words, beyond what is important about my own body half the time. And I need that to be important to you. And I don't know that, I mean, I know that's not the right way to say that, but you know what I'm trying to get to is that the ways in which we can express that to them. What are your recommendations in ways that we can do that the right way?
Yeah. So, and again, hindsight 2020, the best way to do it is to have the consequences already determined. Here, you have access to this phone now. If at any point you use this phone in an inappropriate way, which we're defining as X, Y, and Z, the phone comes back to me for however long. So the best way to do any repercussions is to have it set up ahead of time. Again, I recognize that that is not always the case. And oftentimes we don't realize we need repercussions until something has already happened. So then the second way, the in the moment crisis response is validating first. So validating their experiences, acknowledging places where they handled it well. If they came and told you before you found it in their phone, that's awesome. That shows a lot of maturity. Maybe their behaviors leading up to it didn't. And so then the conversation, so it's a lot of validation at first. And then if the child's old enough and calm enough, I prefer to co-create the consequences with them. What do you think is a fair consequence for these behaviors that led up to this? What do you think you should have done differently? And what do you think is fair? And if it's fair, go with it. Let the kid decide. Oftentimes they give themselves a harsher punishment than the parents were going to anyways. If the child's not in that space, parents' knee-jerk reaction is just take it all. Take all the screens, take the phones, take the friends, put them in a bubble safely in their room where nothing can happen. But the child feels that as I'm being punished for coming to you to tell you that something happened. And so it's more going back to, it seemed like you weren't really able to handle having a phone 24/7. That's a really big responsibility. A lot of adults can't do that. So let's put the phone on a timer. Let's keep the phone in the living room or in the kitchen at night. And that's a big one. That's one I would suggest just never let your kids have their phone in their room at night, because most of this stuff happens at night. But if they already have it there, that, you know, again, hindsight's 2020. But you change the rules of the phone use, but don't take it away completely. I use the Bark phones for my kids. I really like it. It can get overwhelming as the parent because you get a lot of notifications for everything, but it at least lets me know what I need to talk to them about. It quickly highlights There was this text thread that had things about sex. And so I can quickly just look at that part of the text thread and be like, oh, no, that was fine. Or that might be worth a conversation. I can see what they're on. I can track them. And they know it. Like, it's not like hidden on their phone. Their phone is a Bark phone. They know it from the beginning. They know I get these things. And so it opens up the conversation early instead of waiting. But there's an app as well as several different phones. But I find that helpful because it opens the conversation before they have to come and tell you and before you're snooping through their phone.
Mm-hmm. And it makes it more understood in my mind. I look at that as saying you have a deadline for your science fair project. I know what it is, and so do you. You're the owner of this. You're going to lead it. I'm going to help you, but we're going to get there when we get there. And so that, to me, is, it's so much easier to set the ground rules ahead of time. But what I also hear you saying is late is better than never. You still want to be able to protect, and there are ways to do that. Monday through Friday, you don't get to keep your phone in your room. We're going to wean yourself back off of it or whatever, that there are ways to creatively do that together that you can. I love the idea of co-creating both the consequences and the original rules in the first place. What do you feel like is a good idea and how we can keep both of us comfortable with your safety? I tend to go overprotective. I have pregnancy loss. I have infant loss in my story. And so I go overprotective, which then comes out as overwhelm, yelling, stress response, those kinds of things. But I do always, I'm always intentional and say, I'm very stressed right now. I'm just going to walk away and then I'm going to come back to you. But I also do too late. I already responded. apology and say that I was overprotective. That was me bringing my stuff, my fear to the table that I didn't need to bring. I apologize. Where were we? Let's start over and let's have this conversation the right way. So I hear you saying there are a myriad ways that we can attempt this with our family. And you know your kids as a parent and guardian, you know your kids better than anybody. Attempt it how it works, but always come back to that love space, that trust place, that respect place, and you're always going to win.
Yeah, as long as you're making your choices for your child based on true care for them, they're going to see that. They know. Kids, like, I see a lot of like new therapists and a lot of new teachers doing this fake I care about you routine. Kids look through that. They can tell so fast. They know when somebody is being genuine in their care and genuine in their response. And so they're a lot more willing to forgive your mistakes if they come from a place of care.
Well, that gives me a lot of confidence then, because I am constantly saying my response is because I love you so much and that I just want you to be safe. I also want to teach them to make safe decisions, not make fearful decisions, but make safe decisions based on what we know that could happen. So it's a fine line. But how has your parenting changed as a result of all of your amazing work that you're doing?
I probably am significantly more aware than most parents about what lives out there in the online space. So I am not a super overprotective parent in general. Like, I'm more of the, yeah, fall and break your arm and, you know, let's get it out of the way, climb the tree, walk into town with a sibling, whatever. But when it comes to the online space, I'm probably more overprotective than most parents. My kids had a flip phone at first. My oldest is 14 and needed the ability to engage in group chats for work stuff. And so I had to finally cave. And like I said, I went full bark phone instead of apps or checking. I feel more comfortable having all of those layers of protection and checking. Again, I don't think that that's the only way to do it. I don't think it's the perfect way for all families, but it makes me feel more comfortable with them having it. So on that side, that definitely has come from what I work with. I'm more honest with them about what's out in the world. The more work I do, the more I see what kids are exposed to at a much younger age. So there's conversations that I've had with them that I didn't expect to have as young. For example, this usually surprises parents. The average age to come across porn is 12. So you're having to have conversations about seeing porn before they're 12. But depending on your family dynamics and your values and how you talk about sex and sexuality, you might not have planned to have a conversation about any of that, much less porn. But if you're not having those conversations with them, the reality is they're seeing this stuff without any conversation and making sense of it with whatever their 12-year-old brain is able to make sense of. So I'm having conversations earlier than I thought I would, more direct than I thought I would. And then on the other side, working with families and working with and in these spaces, I do think my parenting is significantly stronger than it would have been. Just having the awareness of what's developmentally appropriate, having the awareness of what's within norms, what's not, how to have these tough dialogues, having to have difficult dialogues all the time with various people makes it easier to have it with my own children.
I can imagine that your practice muscle has been well defined. You have had lots of practice and having hard conversations. And again, around things that we as children, it was stigmatized against. And that's part of the reason that this whole thing has happened. So we have this, we've always had these conversations past two and a half years about our bodies, about sex, about the things that we know are absolutely and completely normal processes, and what to do, what to call things, how to handle talking about things, all those things. And there's very little embarrassment amongst the five of us because of that. And I feel good about that based on what you're telling me. So that is so helpful to know that we need to be having harder conversations, obviously, but also specific ones. So I love that. And like I said, I'm just glad to learn from you because I don't ever profess to be some mom that knows all of the answers. And when you have multiples, and those are your only children, alive children, that makes it even funner to be able to figure it out all at once, because you're dealing with three kids that are the same age, but that handle life in very different ways.
Right.
I wanted to ask your perspective on this. Is it's not just one conversation. You don't just say one time, okay, you need to be careful of so-and-so and look for these words, or if there's a picture that makes you uncomfortable, we need to have a conversation around it. Okay, now go forth and go do your thing. It's a conversation, right?
Yeah. It's ongoing conversation. Again, in my household, it's probably daily, every other day. But again, they hear me on the phone and they see my work, and so they're actively engaged in what I do, anyways. And so they'll often ask, what was that about? What happened to that child? And, you know, I can't share details, but I can share broad strokes. And so We talk about it regularly. I think most families wouldn't and probably shouldn't, because it's just like, then it becomes fear mongering. If it's parents constantly being like, here's what you're worried for, here's what you're looking for. But a way that I find is helpful is if you see something in the news, or there's an article that pops up, or, you know, a commercial on something, and it has a theme of one of those things, that's an easy way to have that conversation without it being mom and dad are just trying to make us scared of the world. Then it's, huh, what did you think about that commercial? I had some thoughts. I'm wondering what you thought. Or, huh, that was interesting. And just see what they have to say. And the more that you open dialogues like that, the more likely it is that they'll come to you with it. And that's kind of where I am with my kids. Like, they'll see somebody walk by, like, they saw an older guy and a younger girl, and the guy was kind of like, holding her arm kind of tight. And they're like, do you think that girl's safe? And it wasn't me being like, oh, watch out. They're learning to see things around them, and they're gaining in that awareness. And really, that's, as parents, that's all we can do. All we can do as a parent is gain their awareness. After that, it's up to them. All we can do is kind of give them a broad stroke of, this is what's out in the world, and here are some things that you might want to be aware of. But after that, whether or not it turns into a bad situation for them or not, that's really on them and their ability to both identify the problem and feel safe coming to tell somebody about it.
The awareness piece again. Yeah, absolutely. It's the education of that awareness and being aware of all kinds of things that are happening in their body. It's a much bigger conversation, but we could talk about that for more hours. How can we work with Ashley? Is there a way to get your book, to understand more about self-care for caregiving? What are those things that we can do to work with you outside of this podcast episode?
Yeah, so you can go to my personal work website, which is apoklar.org. There are some free resources on it that include, I think one of them is how to talk to your child about internet use and things like that. There's one about how to talk to your child about grief. And a lot of these arose from spaces when I was working in schools and we were handing it out to all parents after something happened, or spaces that I was struggling with as a parent and kind of wrote through the process that I use. So there's free resources there. You can reach out to me directly for consultation. I also, and I don't keep up with it nearly as much as I should, but I do some blog posting, so you can get into like my psyche and real moments that I had as a parent and how I navigated those. One of my favorites on there is talking about balancing and how I think the idea of balancing home and life or home and work is a joke, and more how I integrate instead. So there's some useful things there. And again, you can reach out to me directly through that. When we're talking more the exploitation side of things, the organization I work with is called Sentinel Foundation. The website is foundationsentinel.org. We are on social media as well. And so oftentimes I'll put out PSAs or just notes. You can follow the work we do. And again, Sentinel Foundation for that. The book, I have the main part written. I still have to do the planner that's going to go with it. But once that's done, it'll be through both my what it done in the next couple of months. And then another really exciting thing that I'm working on that I hope will go live by end of summer is a awareness building program for parents and teens. It'll be a mirror program where you're getting the same information, but directed towards the teen, directed towards the parent. And it encourages communication with each other, talks about all of the internet safety pieces, as well as gives skills for the parent and skills for the teen on how to communicate with each other effectively. And the way you pass each module or each class is to engage in some sort of conversation or activity with one another.
Very cool. Wow. I'm excited about all of those things personally, but I know that the audience will be as well. Thank you so much for your honesty and for your vulnerability. I know we didn't talk about your personal story, but I really feel like this is such an amazing way for people to learn from you. And I'm really excited to have had this conversation. Thank you so much for being here.
Not a problem. Thank you for having me.